My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I want to thank him for that wonderful introduction. Always nice to shake hands with the chairman as you come up. Couldn't wait to get out of here. And Joe, this probably sounds like it's pretty emotional on short notice, but as far as I can tell, it's really true. If I just had one day left to live and one meeting in my life left, I would like to have you chair it. Really. I know it would make it seem like it was forever. I'm glad to be here tonight. I've got a lot of time, actually. I had some playoff tickets for Wednesday night, but I don't have to hurry back for that anymore. So I will have to take refuge as a Braves fan. I used to see the Braves play all the time when they were in Milwaukee. So I was an old Milwaukee Braves fan when Eddie Matthews and Hank Aaron and all those guys were playing. And so I have kind of a warm spot in my heart for... I'm glad the Braves won, really. If the Dodgers couldn't, I'm glad the Braves won. It doesn't make a difference to anybody anyway, but... I was having a lunch Thursday with an ex-Dodger first baseman who was probably one of their best first basemen ever, and he was saying, I hate to say this, but he said, I'd like to see the Braves win. And he said, they're young, hungry, vibrant guys, and our guys are all kind of old and overpaid and they're blasé. I'd like to see those young guys do it. So I'm glad they won. And then to increase my pleasure, tonight I was able to, when I was getting ready to come down here, I was able to see the Raiders get beat by the Chargers who won their first game of the year. I know how it feels like to be a Falcon fan, I guess. This has not been a good day for sports folks in Los Angeles, I'll tell you. But I'm glad to be here. I want to briefly apologize to the Al-Anon speaker. I don't know if she's still here. Sue, are you here anywhere? Probably not. She had to go. She had to leave. Why should I apologize for the hell of there? Never did like her, now that I think about it. But I came in near the end of her talk. I just came in. I sat down briefly to get out of the way, and she noticed me come in. And then I had to leave. She had to think my bags were sitting out in the lobby, and I hadn't checked in. And so I went back out again. I could just see her give me the ray. As I walked back out, she gave me a full-scale release. And now she's gone away. But fortunately, her husband's sponsor, I'm his sponsor. So I'll shape her up next week. We are here tonight to talk a little bit about alcoholism, I guess, and its problems and its recovery therefrom. And I'm glad to be in Columbus. I've never been to Columbus before, and I know a little bit about it. It's a nice historical city. But I'm primarily glad to be here to discuss this subject because it's one that baffled me most of my life. Like most of you, I suppose, I had a lot of difficulty accepting the fact that I needed to be here. And I had a lot of difficulty accepting the fact there was anything here I needed. Because all of my adult life, I've had the feeling that there's something different about me, and it's the sort of difference that simple therapies like Alcoholics Anonymous don't have much effect on. In looking over my life, it seems to me that most of my life I've had the feeling that my emotions seem to be more intense than other people's. And I don't know why, but it's almost as though I feel things too intensely. I remember years ago when I was long before I ever stayed sober, but I went to an AA meeting and a guy said, what do you think your problem is? I said, I think I'm too sensitive. And he laughed, just like you laughed. And I never told anybody that again. But I always felt it, but I never told anybody, which again told me that was something different. That was something other people didn't have, and that's why they laughed at it. I come from a little town up in northern Wisconsin, when I was a young boy, early in the Second World War, I escaped, and I was full of enthusiasm and joy and zip. And I, early in the Second World War, I wanted to get out of there, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had no idea how far it was. I looked in the school library in the map, and it was about a page and a half. Didn't seem very far. And I hadn't been anywhere. I was dumb and small and little. And I, thank God, one guy picked me up outside of Minneapolis and drove me all the way to San Francisco. And I didn't know that was unusual. I just thought that's how you do it, you hitchhike. And he was the Navy, and he was driving out to the West to get a ship. And I was telling him, I want to get the Marines and kill Japs. And I was about this big, a face full of pimples. And he just said, well, kid, they may not be ready to use you quite yet, but he took me all the way to San Francisco, put me on a ferry boat one morning at 6 o'clock in the morning in Oakland, gave me a buck, and I got to San Francisco. And I went up to this, he told me how to get to the Coast Guard office. And I went up there and I applied, I was 15, I applied for sea. He said, tell him you want to be a merchant seaman. And I didn't know anything, I just said, I want to be a merchant seaman. He said, but tell him you're 16. I said, I'm 16. I guess they were crying for men, so they gave me an application, and I filled it out. And then they said, well, you're only 16, kid. You'll have to have your parents give their permission. So I took it around the block and got my parents to sign. And came back, and they issued me seaman's papers. That's how desperate they were at that time. They told me how to get to the National Maritime Union. I went down there, and they were crying for guys to put on ships. And they said, sign this waiver to take care of your union dues. I signed the waiver and union dues, and they sent me over to the Embarcadero, and I went over to see these enormous ships. I got one of these ships. Couldn't believe my eyes. Anything's that big. And just got on there, and away they went. And I remember that day so clearly. I'd never smelled salt air before. I'd never seen anything like this. Big ships. I remember going underneath the Bay Bridge, and somebody said, that's Treasure Island. That's where the World's Fair was a couple years ago. Ooh. And we went by Treasure Island, Alcatraz, and tried to see Al Capone. And underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, I'd seen pictures of that in school, and God, it's just magnificent. We just kept sailing, and pretty soon the earth was going out of sight, and I had an intuitive feeling, I suppose, that I had made the first in an endless series of career errors. And I sidled up to one of the guys with gold in their hat and said, well, this is very nice, but I got to get back now. I got a big English test Monday. And I guess he wished me well. He told me to luck off. And another guy said, go to your forecastle. Sit there. And I didn't know what a forecastle was, but it sounded terrible. And I had my little bag, and I went in this forecastle. If you've ever been on a ship, it just means that's where the crew sleeps, sleeping rooms. And I was in a room, it turned out later, with one watch, one deck watch, four guys in a room, and you were the deck watch for one four-hour period, two. And so I went in there, and I didn't know that. I saw three of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, pimply-faced, dumbbell kid could ever see. These kind of people are called men. And I guess when they saw me, they realized, oh, Jesus. They know they're going to have to do their work and a third of mine from then, each of them. Because I didn't know anything. And I could see there was a little tension in the air, so I told them some little stories that used to kill them in study hall. And they,
why don't you get in your goddamn bunk and shut up?
So I got in my goddamn bunk and shut up. And that old boat was going around, and I started to get seasick, and the lad was out of sight, and then these guys start talking, and it turns out they'd been in San Francisco about 4 days, 5 days, and they'd been doing terrible things. I'm a Norwegian Lutheran, and we lead a pretty sheltered life, and I just had never heard of anything like that. I just couldn't believe my ears. I thought, these are sinners. These people must be Catholics. And they got talking about sex, and I just turned my face to the wall. And, I mean, I don't give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And I didn't know these pictures came to life in San Francisco. I don't know that I ever felt worse than I did that day. One of these guys went to his locker and got into a sea bag and did something I didn't know was absolutely illegal. Took out a bottle of whiskey. He turned to his friend and said, "You want a snort?" He goes, "Yeah." To me, "Want a snort?" He goes, "Yeah." And he turned to me with had a singularly unpleasant look in his face. Now that I'm more sophisticated, very slick, I would call it a demeaning look or a patronizing look or something. But then it was just pleasant or unpleasant, and this was unpleasant. He said, "How about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?" He shoved that bottle in my face. And all sports fans are familiar with a phenomenon called choking. Dodgers just did it this weekend, but I mean... What that means, in effect, is that you get so wrapped up with emotion, you cannot function. Just an invisible hand comes out of your shirt and goes, "Ah." And if you're batting, you just, "Ah." The ball. And if you're playing football, you wait for a putt and, "Ah, oh, God." On and on. But it also happens in the real world of conversation. I couldn't talk. I just, "Ah." Now, this sounds strange. I had never, to the best of my knowledge, I'd never been in the same room with a bottle of whiskey at that age. I'd never seen one close up. I'd seen them in movies, but I'd never seen a bottle of whiskey. That's incredible today. And I was raised in a church where you didn't ever drink. And I couldn't say anything, but I just thought at him as fast and as hard as I could. I could just feel my pimple standing up, you know. And I was thinking at him, "How dare you put that whiskey in my face? I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. Norwegian Lutherans don't drink whiskey. Even if they did, I promised both my mother and grandmother I would never drink whiskey. Even if I hadn't promised them, what I know about life, I learned at the movies. And in my era, at any rate, good guys never drank. Bad guys drank. Errol Flynn never took a drink in his life, as far as I know. Never in Sherwood Forest. Always some old craphead like Basil Rathbone or some other fool. I just... couldn't stand the idea, and that guy sticking that in my face and just saying, "You think you're mad enough for a little snort?" And I was thinking at him, and I heard a voice say, "God damn right." Turns out I'm a little weak under pressure, too. So I had my first drink, and it burned my mouth and burned my throat and burned my stomach and burned my stomach and burned my throat and burned my mouth and burned his shirt.
"Get the bottle away from the little bastard."
And I was humiliated. What I remember about that moment is that I was humiliated, not the sickness, the humiliation. Because there's nothing in the world worse than being insecure and knowing you're inadequate and having people notice it and publicly laugh at you. That's the kind of thing, if you had a gun, you'd just shoot people, momentary anger and rage. I thought later, I had nothing I could do, but there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They would have thrown me overboard. But what I might have done, if I'd have thought of it, I said, "Hey, buddy, lean over."
"Yeah."
"Take that." Yeah. Give him a zip right in the old eye just to teach him. But all the way across the Pacific Ocean, every day I'd sneak into that guy's sea bag when nobody's around and take a drink of that slop. And I hated it, and I'd throw it up. But I would do anything to have those guys not laugh at me. And we were in Pearl Harbor, got into Pearl Harbor, got his brekkie still smoking on Ford Island, and war hadn't been going on very long. These guys were up on deck, and I was down in the forecastle trying to drink another drink of that slop, and I took a drink, and it burned my throat and burned my stomach and stayed there. And I thought, "Oh, God, if I could just do this and smile." Oh. And all of a sudden, I got a wonderful feeling. At the moment, all I thought of, "This, I really feel much better." That's all I ever thought about. And made me feel significantly better. And I suddenly realized I am just like those guys. In retrospect, I think I felt, that was the first time I ever felt the way men looked. And it just made me feel wonderful. If I'd known a sea chanty, I'd have sung it. Then I got sick and threw up and went away again. But for a few moments, I realized that's the way men feel. And I didn't become a terrible old drunk after that. I tried to learn to drink little by little. Later in the war, I went in the Navy and drank. I didn't become a terrible old drunk. I don't necessarily like being drunk and in trouble. I like to drink, though, and have that feeling. And at the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital up in Northern California getting sewed up. And I took some tests that they were passing out to everybody, so I was able to get a high school equivalency. I'm still a junior in Eau Claire High School. And I went to college after the war and fell into the trap that other people fell into of all the veterans, the first post-war class of veterans. We all stood around on street corners trying to look like steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers. Got married in college, because everybody's getting married. And where I live, everybody in that whole town has got brown hair or blonde hair. So if you see any girl with black hair, it always looks exotic. So I met this girl with black hair in college, and she was a Catholic. My grandmother tried to warn me. She said, "Oh, Sonny," she said, "she's a nice girl, but don't marry a Catholic. You'll be sorry." I said, "Grandma, we've been over there in the Pacific fighting the forces of fascism, bigotry, so we don't have to live with intolerance. She's a wonderful girl. We're going to get married." And I married that girl, and my grandmother was right. It isn't that she was a bad girl. She was a good girl. And I don't know if you ever know this, but there's something they never tell little Lutheran boys. If you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family, whether you want one or not. I used to plead with her. I said, "Can't we use birth control?" She said, "No." You know, I think about it now. Everybody was so repressed. I was so repressed that if she had said yes, I don't know how the hell I would have gotten any birth control. I'd been ashamed to ask for it. I guess that's the difference in generations. In the late 1940s, guys would go into the drugstore and they'd say, "Hey, give me a pack of cigarettes and some condoms." Now, at least in my neighborhood, they go in and say, "Hey, give me some condoms and some cigarettes." I guess that's progress. I'd try to help her. I'd say, "We don't have to take orders from some old guy in Rome wearing a white dress, do we?" And that didn't do any good. And she had a priest come by one day, and he gave me an hour and a half on the rhythm system, which I don't know if you know what that is. That's the Catholic version of birth control. And I listened intently, and I just couldn't pick up that beat. I started my career as a distributor of small Catholics nationally. It's one of the reasons I don't have any hair in front. You know how many times I've said, "You're what?" But I went out of the world, and I became a sports writer and on newspapers, and then my wife kept having babies, so I had to get better jobs, and I got advertising, public relations, get a lot of jobs, and became somewhat successful intermittently. But my problem always was, it seemed to me, as far back as I remember, I'm always fighting these damn emotions, these damn feelings, and these feelings of anxiety and despair and loneliness sometimes, and all kinds of things. And they're not all there at once. They come and go, bloop, 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 like a bubbling pot. As a young man, I realized you can't really live with this kind of stuff, so I went to psychoanalysis. And a lot of people say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis, and they say, "Is that an A?" But I loved it. Now, of course, I went years ago. AA's been kind of, analysis has been kind of spoiled in the last few years because so many little people have been there, but in my day, just the thinkers were there. And I discovered things. For instance, I discovered I had been repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Now, I'll tell you, I was so sorry to hear that, because I don't kind of like the church, you know, and now it turns out they'd psychologically repressed me, and that had caused deep scars. I thought, damn them, damn them. If I knew now what I knew then, and if I knew then what I know now, I should say, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. I have a granddaughter who's graduating this year at the University of New Mexico. And I haven't given my grandchildren much. I've given her blue eyes. All my children have brown eyes, and all my grandchildren have blue eyes like me, some kind of recessive gene. And I've given them all kind of a sick sense of humor. And she's telling me that she's thinking of, in Albuquerque at the university, starting the first chapter of Children, of adult children of alcoholics. I said, why do you want to start a thing like that? She says, I just like the acronym, CUCA. Well, I sent her to her room. I discovered I'd been deprived as a child. I discovered that I had been deprived. I didn't know that. I didn't know there'd been a depression, the psychiatrist told me later. But I didn't have anything. I remember all started innocuously. One day the doctor said, you mean to say, Mr. Emerson, at this time in 1935, in this little town, you didn't have a bicycle? I said, no. But I got thinking about it on the way home. I began to remember I never had anything. It took me about 2 months. Every time I wanted to really go into a deep, meaningful depression, I'd think about that. Now, we always say, people like us, well, we don't want depressions. We all want depressions. We need them every so often just to rinse off. It's like having your own portable cross. You just set it up. And, you know. Don't forgive them, Father. They know what they do. You know. And I used to think, I used to get a mental picture in my mind of a little tousled-haired, apple-cheeked, blue-eyed, kind of brave little tyke, clean but raggedy clothes, watching his little friends ride their bicycles. Don't worry about me, I'll go into psychoanalysis. Took me almost 2 months to remember nobody had a bicycle in Eau Claire. One kid finally got one, we beat him up and broke his bicycle. But I discovered a lot of things in psychoanalysis. I had breakthroughs that sent shivers down my spine. I began to realize that just a mass of scars. Now, I guess that's good information to have, but for people like me, what it does, it really has a terrible effect. It plays to the victim inside of me. And boy, most of my life, I've always enjoyed being a victim, because when I'm a victim, it's not my fault. In fact, that's something to think about in AA sometimes if I forget to say it later. And that is, most of us have played part of our lives by becoming victims, and we get in therapies that tell us we're victims. And the one thing about makes AA stand out is that for the first time you can become the hero of your life. You don't have to be a damn victim anymore. You don't have to lay down and whimper how sad it is. But when you're going through it, you don't know any better. It seems like, boy, I'm a victim and a lot of things. And one of the things that kept me going, I spent thousands of dollars and a lot of time doing it, is that I've always had the feeling, and I'm sure a lot of you have it right now, if I can just find out why I have all these damn feelings, if I can just get to the root of these feelings, I'll be all right. And I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars in years of my life examining why in different therapies. Now, I want to give you some good news and some bad news. The good news is you can find out why you have these feelings. In different therapies, you get different answers, but they'll appear to be valid. The bad news is it doesn't help. You wind up feeling crappy and knowing why. I think the only possible use of that information might be late night in a bar where somebody says, hey, what the hell's wrong with you? Well, I'm emotionally scarred. I never had a bicycle and... Shut up! Later on, I got into metaphysics because my emotions were getting worse and worse. And I had to go to the whip. I got into metaphysics. I was about half crazy by this time, so I really had a head start. I was really in there with the finite oneness of the universal self. And I don't like to gloat. It's hard enough, you know, to live in the South without having people come down here to gloat, but I'm just joking. But at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of 6 people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And I thought that would make him respect me, but they put me in the insane asylum, is what they did. I read books. If there's any terrible depressives here, if you want to read something that'll help you, there's a book called The Decline of the West by a man named Oswald Spengler, who was a German philosopher of sorts. He wrote murky stuff. I mean, let me tell you about reading philosophy also. People are looking. If you're by yourself, you can say, what? what the hell is this all about? But if people are looking, you say, how true. You know. But this decline of the West proves that everything you believe in, all your ideals, all the people, all the places, all the institutions that seem wonderful, are all false. The whole world is a scam, and it's just a big laugh. And I don't know why, but if you're depressive, that cheers you up. I don't know why. Another one I'd like to recommend to you, if you want to even go crazier, you might like a man named Nietzsche, Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, who... What I liked about him is this. I was raised in, as I said, the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and I can joke about it, but there's one thing you know in the Norwegian Church. If you become a sinner or monkey with Catholics, you're going to go to hell. And I'd become a sinner, and then I'm monkeyed with Catholics. So there was not much hope. And I could joke about it and pretend to be, I don't care, but late at night, it's like Hitler says, you give me their minds till they're 12, and there'll be a little bit of Nazi in them till they're 90. And you let me educate some kid that if you're bad, you're going to go to hell till he's 12. When he's grown up, unless something happens, when he's 2 o'clock in the morning, he wakes up, he knows he's going to go to hell. And I didn't like that. I joined imitation atheistic societies and dispelled belief in God. One time a guy and I in Dallas, we were so cute, they caught us before somebody blew the whistle at us, but God, it would have been cute. We were going to put in the Dallas phone book a dial a prayer for atheists, where you dial this number and nobody would ever answer. You just... No. That's what you can do when you're really cute. But what I liked about Nietzsche, one of his characters, one of his pieces says, why are you concerned about God? God is dead. He perhaps once lived to set the orbs of the world, but look at the chaos about you. Natural law continues, but no divine intervention. Do not be afraid of God. God no longer exists. I remember reading that thinking, boy, that's good news. That is good news. That's true. I got a chance. And I remember reading that, and I liked Nietzsche. And let me tell you how people warp things, though. There's a theological seminary in Chicago that has that quotation on the wall. It says, God is dead. Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. And beneath it, it says, Nietzsche's dead. Signed God, 1906. You know, yeah. Always something bad happening in Chicago. Try to remember what row you're in, miss. I read books. I did a lot of things. But the one thing that helped me the most is something I paid very little attention to. Is that when my emotions got out of whack, the thing that helped them better than anything in the world was a few drinks. A few drinks, and I know that's no lasting answer, but by God, a few drinks makes me feel better. If I could synthesize my emotions into a general category, I would say that primarily, in retrospect, nearly all of my life, it always seemed to me that of myself, I am not quite enough. And I don't know why, but they seem to know it, and they act like I'm not enough, but they don't tell me why. But there's something different about me that I'm not quite enough. I need something extra going for me. And in addition to that, I have very few defenses, because it seems to me other people are born with at least a little armor to protect them against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, as it were. But somehow or other, my armor's been stuck open. And people can just get to me with things, and they make me... I don't try not to show it, but my gut churns, a tone of voice, a memo, a change of things. Just I can't stand rejection, because I just know I should be rejected. So I can't stand rejection. And the other thing is that whenever I have become somewhat successful, it's always accompanied by a kind of a cold, nameless fear. They're going to find me out. I don't even know if they're going to find out, but they're going to find me out. I didn't identify at the time. I could see it in retrospect. And so I go through life not quite enough and feeling vulnerable and this cold fear. And I tried a lot of therapies, but I'll tell you something. A few drinks is the only thing that I've ever found in my life that almost instantly beats that condition. A few drinks, at least if you're like me, takes people who are not quite enough and makes them somewhat more than enough. A few drinks takes people who feel highly vulnerable and makes them temporarily invulnerable. A few drinks takes people who have fear, makes them momentarily omnipotent. Screw you, Jack. A few drinks, I'll tell you, a few drinks makes me feel the way men look, and always has. And I, the only problem I've ever had with alcohol is that I have an unfortunate tendency to drink too much sometimes. I overfill my holes. And then I have a little difficulty because I have a tendency sometimes. My psychiatrist said I was repressed so long that when I burst loose, I become a little flamboyant. And I like to be with other flamboyant people. Let's go to Juarez. I want to be around people who say, yeah! I don't want to be around some wimp who says, why? It's so late. Screw you, Jack. I like drinking adds a little technicolor to a gray tunnel called life. I'm sure most of you have known that life is primarily a gray, endless, stinking tunnel. A few little things here and there. That's what I always hate about AA. You go to AA, and it's a constricted gray tunnel. And I guess for the rest of your life, you get up every morning and just say, oh, good. Another endless, damn gray day. Look at the hall. It's just wonderful. I'm so happy to be sober. Is there anything up ahead I can look forward to? Yes, there is. After a year, a hatch opens and some scrawny arm drops a 39-cent cake. Is that all? That's all. Hello! And I guess a lot of people like that, but repressed people don't. People have had a lot of internal scarring. People have been victimized. I need a little excitement. And so I drink, and I drink a little too much sometimes, and sometimes I get really drink too much, and sometimes I get a little flamboyant. So a lot of people think my problem is alcohol. I know it isn't. But so I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. That's a long time ago, before some of you were born. And I hated it. I mean, I was 22. 22 doesn't sound very young now, but then nobody heard of anybody within 20 years of it. You know, and they looked at me like I was some young freak. I looked at them like they were old burned out fools is what they were in their late 30s and 40s. Just, I thought I was in God's waiting room, you know, just. There wasn't any room for young people then. That's one of the things I try to remember now to say, because there's so many young people in AA. There's a whole row of them here and there and throughout this room. And there's a lot of young people in my home group in Los Angeles. And I sometimes have to remember to tell them, so I'll tell you too, that you are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And if you're like the young people in our group, I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. Jesus Christ, you're just making me crazy. I went to AA for a while, but that was no answer. Then I got into psychoanalysis. I got into other therapies, and I did a lot of things. But I went to AA from time to time. The trouble with AA is this. There's something that differentiates me from them. My problems are rather deep and complex, and I can't get a fix on them. Their problems is primarily alcohol. And they get sober and shape up and straighten up their act, and they feel good. When I get sober and try to straighten up my act, I feel good for a little bit till one day here come my pals back. Fear and desperation and loneliness and feeling different and restlessness, that our book says discontent. And there's a low-level feeling I never even identified. I had it all my life. I never even identified it until the guy told it to me, telling me his inventory one night. I was so cross that he had more insight than I was. I almost pushed him on my car. But you know, one of the great emotions of my life was something I never paid any attention to because it isn't very flamboyant. It's just a low-level, almost continual feeling of unease. Just kind of, this isn't it either. This isn't what I wanted. I thought it was, but it isn't. And always, I need something more. And drinking, a few drinks changes that. Drinking has a little technicolor. I need a little technicolor. You know, years ago, I started sitting with my older grandchildren now, were younger. At Christmas time, they used to have the Wizard of Oz at Christmas time. I'd sit in my big chair. I thought that'd be a nice image. Watch the Wizard of Oz. And I did that over the years. And I still do. I keep having grandchildren. Endless supply. Jesus. Love the little tykes. I'll tell you a little something that you may have never learned till now. And you will never hear it in another AA meeting as long as you live. Now, you are lucky enough to be here tonight to hear it. This is my own breakthrough. Perhaps you've noticed why grandchildren and grandparents get along very well as a rule. They really get along quite well. And people say, why can that be? They share a common enemy. I wouldn't want that to get outside of this room. But I sit with watch this Wizard of Oz for 20 years now. And at the end, I just, even to this day, I feel like saying, Dorothy, don't go back to Kansas! Grace is all gray back there. Stay with the technicolor. You know, there may be wicked witches here. You get used to them, I did. You know, hey. Drinking is just something great. I love drinking, and I drink too much sometimes, and I get in trouble, and I'm a little too flamboyant, and it costs me problems, and I try to do it differently, and I kind of have a checkered career. One spring, I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in the suburb of Chicago. By the end of that same year, I was playing piano in a cheap bar in San Francisco. My family stuck in a farm up in Wisconsin with their parents. A year and a half later, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas, directing a grand opera. End of that year, I was in the Texas State Insane Asylum directing a Christmas pageant. You know, not quite as complex as an opera. You know, the director's main job was trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you possibly. We just want to worship her, Clancy. Back, Lamar, back. Year after that, I was in Dallas at the largest advertising agency in the South. Some guys and I, people decided I'd learned my lesson. And some guys and I were writing these old Elsie and Elmer ads for the board company, if you're old enough to remember those old cows talking to each other. And 8 months after that, I was on the floor of the Phoenix drunk tank, waking up when the guy had just got done kicking all my front teeth down my throat. You vomit on my bunk, you drunken son of a bitch, you know. I woke up that morning. It was one of the few mornings I was ever glad I'd been in psychoanalysis, because once you've been in psychoanalysis, at least you get some overview and some insight. And I was so sick I couldn't move my head out of the way of this guy's shoe while he kicked my teeth out. But I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. You know? Makes you feel a little better. And a couple of months after that, I found myself being thrown out of a Skid Row mission. He says, and stay out. And he literally, physically threw me out. And I tried to explain to the guy, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I directed a grand opera. Ads that I wrote with some other guys are running this very week in Life and Collier's and Saturday Evening Post. They're running right now the ads I wrote 2 years ago. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know, when you have no front teeth, you can't hit those consonants quite as cleanly as you'd like. When I stood outside of a Skid Row mission, and if a guy had come up to me and said, are you an alcoholic, pal? I'd have had to say, no, I'm not, but I wish I were. I wish I were. I would be something if I were. But there's something different about me, and I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. And I can't find out. And nobody will tell me. It started to rain, and I walked 71 blocks out to an AA club. I'd been asked to leave a week or two before that for fighting drunken. And I hung around that club, and I just hated it. I've been in out of A for year after year after year and hear this same crap and these same speakers saying the same, I don't know if I ever heard him, but it always seemed to me, whenever I went to a meeting where there's a speaker, always the same speaker, whatever state I was in. Friends, I stayed drunk around the clock 25 years. One day I walked through that door and the desire for alcohol left me like a cloak fluttering to the floor. I now have $3 million with me tonight. Several different families have returned to me. And I want all the one thing. I put the plug in the jug. And I feel wonderful. And we're just sitting there deciding which hurts least, hanging yourself or cutting your wrists, you know. I remember thinking, I wish I had one curare dart, just while just... Tell us how that feels, you old sumbitch. Yeah. There's something wrong, but I don't know what it is. I hung around that club, and I had no place to live. There was an old abandoned car way back in the parking lot, and I thought, this is the end of the trail. I'm living in the abandoned car back of a parking lot that's full of AA members, and they're goofy.
Turn it over. Live and let live. Ha, 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 ha. First thing first. Park the steps. See my muscle.
And they did the same thing back then as they do now. They said things like, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. I got a guy I used to see in the movies. He was a character actor. I played loving roles. So I got him to be my sponsor. And it turned out those were just roles he played. He should have won the Academy Award for everyone because he was a power drunk dictator, crazy, intimidating. Bob, can't we reason this? Shut up! That's not what I was looking for. I've been around AA for many years. I know how a sponsor should act. You know, you don't really call a sponsor till, try not to call them until you've had a drink. Then you have something to call them about. I just want you to know I've let you and AA down. I've had a drink. Now, if you've got a good sponsor, you say, you haven't let us down. You're just a sick person. You had a relapse. Don't be angry at yourself. I'm coming right over and I'll get some guys and... with you. And if you need a drink, we'll get you one because we want to get you through this. Now, that's why sponsors should act. Everybody knows that. This guy said things to me like, kid, call me whenever you want, day or night. If it's late at night, it better be important. Up till the time you take a drink. Once you take a drink, don't call me because all you're going to hear from me is a dial tone. I don't want to talk, listen to your childish crap. Oh? And he was having me take actions and do things that humiliated me. I tried to stay away from him, really. I had nothing. I knew I was going to be on the street for the rest of my life, but I didn't have to take that. I didn't have to humiliate myself. Some of the worst times of my life in my early sobriety. I'll tell you one of the great turning, probably, I've often thought, one of the turning spots in my life, probably the great turning spot in my life was something I never even identified for years. I was talking about it one day in a meeting and suddenly struck me, God, that changed my life. I was at a Tuesday night meeting at the Central Hollywood meeting. That was really a weird meeting. That's why I went to it. They were weird people. They had spiked hair and dressed funny. This was a long time before the rest of the world was doing it. You know, just, I mean, what's the guy's name? Bela Lugosi used to go to that meeting when he was coming off drugs, you know, and he'd be sitting down there and you'd think, don't bite my neck, you bastard. Just weird, sick people. And I could, it's a participation meeting where they called on people. And I couldn't get called out of that meeting. I went to all these meetings, and I always got called on once, and I'd tell them what I thought, and they never call on me again. I wasn't even an alcoholic, but, you know, at least I could straighten them out a little. And I stand there right by the podium at the coffee break, and I saw a woman who was sitting there in about the second or third row, a woman I particularly hated. Her name was like Mary Lisa or something. And she was one of these girls who were 3 years sober, and everybody just loved Mary Lisa. And isn't she doing wonderful? She sponsors people, and she's so nice. And the kind of person you just want to say, ah, you beast, you know. And I was thinking of her, I think, what would people say if I just went over and smashed her face once? Because she had done something to really hurt my feelings. And here comes my sponsors.
Classy!
Yeah? He said, I want you to apologize to Mary Lisa. I thought, my God, he's read my mind. This is... I said, why? He said, I heard that you called her a bitch at the meeting last night. All right. Bob, don't let it go any further, but she is a bitch, really a bitch. He said, why do you think she's a bitch? Well, she told her new girl not to go to bed with me. I said, well, she's absolutely right. You go to apologize right now. This is the end. Not only was he screaming this at me, but she could hear it. And she was going... this is the end. I used to be a good writer once. I'm going to tell him, I'm going to couch this nicely so there's no misunderstanding. I'm going to tell him what I think of him and AA and all this crap. I'm just working out my mind thinking, Bob, why don't you take the 12 golden steps of recovery, season them with the 12 traditions which are to the group as the steps are to the individual, put a little garnish of the 12 promises that never ever come true to real people, wrap them all in the 12 concepts of world service, and stick them up your nose, because I'm not going to take this crap. I'd rather be dead than be like this. Now, just working this up in my head to turn on him, I was going to give him this. I knew he'd just stagger back. And suddenly, a ray of light came out of heaven and illuminated me. Actually, it was just a passing thought, but it's more dramatic this way. And it suddenly struck me, what in hell am I going through all this for? I'm making such a big deal about this. I've been falling into a trap of thinking, I have to mean these things he wants me to do. I don't have to mean them. I just have to do them. I can laugh at the old fool while I do them. That's ridiculous. Okay, Bob.
Sorry, Mary Lisa.
You lousy bitch. And from then on, I became an activist. Every time he told me to do something, I did it. And I'd laugh at him while I did it. Pick up those cups. Sure, Bob. Ever wonder why you can't get roles in the movies? It's because you're crazy, that's why. I did things. I became an activist. And I laughed at these people. My motives were so terrible. And oddly enough, I started to get better. And I've been getting better little by little ever since. My motives have improved a little bit. But now it's been... this month it'll be 33 years since I walked off Skid Row. And the only therapy I've had in all this time is Alcoholics Anonymous. And it didn't get... Don't misunderstand me. Things didn't get better. The month after that, I was on my way to commit suicide when I got fired as a dishwasher because I had a bad attitude. Yeah. It isn't as bad as you think. I got a job. Somebody put in some clout and got me a job in the Gaiety Delicatessen. And I was washing dishes, and it suddenly struck me, the busboys are bringing in more dishes than the waitresses are taking out. Which led me to believe that the busboys are getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. So I just didn't do a lot of the dishes, and it turned out I miscounted, and I was fired. But I was going to kill myself that day. I was going to drown myself in the ocean a la A Star Is Born. I thought that was a nice way to do it. And I walked, and I couldn't find the ocean. And I called. I stopped at a gas station. I said, where's the ocean, Val? He says, you're just in West Beverly Hills. About another 2 miles past the Veterans Hospital, and then 3 miles past that. I thought, well, I don't mind dying. I'm not going to walk myself to death. And I called up my sponsor. I thought, maybe he can give me a lift. I said, Bob, and he said, why aren't you working? I said, well, Bob, let me tell you, I can't go any further, Bob. Nobody likes me. I'm just going nowhere. I'm just terrible, Bob. What am I going to do? He said, why don't you write your inventory the way I told you? And I had just told him the week before, I don't have to write it. I've taken my inventory with a professional psychiatrist. Why take it with an out-of-work actor, for Christ's sake? You know. And he got crabby about that.
I said, write my inventory. In my judgment, Bob, that's the last thing in the world I need. I'm so full of memories, I can't stand it. In my judgment. He says, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car. If I wanted your judgment, I could put my head in the window and ask you for it. He got me so upset that day that I wrote an inventory. And I was so upset I didn't even edit it as I went along. I put a lot of stuff in there. I didn't look good, I'll tell you. And about a week later, I was going to commit suicide again, so I read it to him. He drove me along the ocean all the way to Oxnard, 40 miles. And I read this. He gave me a flashlight. I did like all of you do. Let me explain this part before I read it. Don't explain it. Just read it. And I got up to Oxnard, and I thought, he's going to push me out of his car. And he went, oh. I thought, he's crazy. But I've taken that ride maybe 200 times since then on the driver's side. And watched some other puke with his flashlight. Let me explain this to you. Shut up. And I'll tell you, if you listen to enough inventories, it's a sad thing to say, but there's nothing ever new. Whenever a guy takes the inventory now, I just think, have something new in there. Just, I don't care what it is. Man, you know, it must be something. I listened to the inventory of the guy who put the flag on the moon. I thought there must be something interesting in here. Same old. There's always some things you can do to your mind and your body. And I'm much more kind than my sponsor. I don't go like that. I turn my head. But I took an inventory. Little by little, I took these steps against my will and for the worst motives. And I started, the time I was a year sober, I finally held a job wrapping packages in an advertising industry. That's what we call the AA rocket to stardom. And I got another job, and I was 2 years sober as a little writer in a medical corporation. Finally, took a chance on me. And I went to my sponsor and said, Bob, I've been saving up some money on the sly. I'm going to get some front teeth. So when I go to work there, I'll really... He said, send that money to your kids. I said, what? He said, send the money to the kids. They need it. Jesus, Bob, they got a front teeth. I don't care. You're a crappy father. Send them the goddamn money. So I did. But I learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people never knew I didn't have front teeth. They just thought they thought I'd been burned in a fire somewhere. But my sponsor insisted I go to work every day, which was against my wishes, but I did. And the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising publications for that big corporation. I had front teeth then, I'll tell you. There are new people here tonight who have lost teeth. Let me give you some hope. Once you become truly spiritual transformed, they grow back. Have your sponsor explain that to you some night. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio. Became the number one hard rock station in the world. There's one young man sitting here who remembers that. Just, we all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? I was 10 years sober at downtown public relations with the oil companies. 15 years sober as a marketing director in Beverly Hills for a publishing firm. When I was 5 years sober, same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to a post office box in Dallas. Leaped out of their post office box, fled to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later. Thank God somebody bought me a metronome then. Now they're all grown up, doing pretty well. My oldest daughter, who was most, if anybody was ever scarred in our family by all the problems going on, she's the only one that's... I'm a little sorry to tell you what she's done. She just was appointed Assistant Attorney General for the state of New Mexico. And I hate to have to tell you, the kid of mine went into law enforcement. But I don't judge. I don't go to New Mexico either, I'll tell you that. That's not quite true. I'm going to be there in 2 weeks. She's got 3 years in A and doing just great. And they're all doing all right. And so now I'm living out in West L.A. by the ocean. My life is fine. And I've been sober a long time. When I was 15 years sober, by the way, I was feeling so good, I resigned a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 17 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And still looking for the guy who did it. Once I thought, I'll get you someday. But it's not a treatment center. It's not a treatment facility at all, or an alcoholic treatment center. It's just a place where we feed 1,700 meals a day to dying men and women, and bed down people and give them clothing and give them some sort of hope for life. Some never get it. But I'm at that stage of my life now where, you know, at the stage of my talk even. I know there are new people here. You get used to this. You go to A meetings. The speakers say, I was way down, and now I'm wonderful. And they don't say it, but they look at you as if to say, I've got it all together, and you haven't. And probably never will have. And so you'll hear it, you'll get sick of those stories. I was down, now I'm wonderful. There's only one thing sometimes you may feel hungry for, as I did when I was new. How in hell do you get from there to there? I mean, it's one thing to say, go to meetings, work the steps, I don't have enough. But that doesn't... What can you do when you're not even an alcoholic, when you're not really an alcoholic, when your case is different? The most important thing I said tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, I said a long time ago, I said, my name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, how could I be an alcoholic when my problem isn't really alcohol? I'm glad that I survived in AA long enough and stayed active to learn the most important single thing I've ever learned about my nature or about the nature of my illness. Anything you've heard before, just this has all been introduction. I'm going to give you a sentence that I hope, if you're new, might change your life. In AA, I learned, finally, that if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not and cannot be alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound upside down and goofy, like some TV inner child crap? But that's the nature of AA, I believe. That's what this program's all about. That's what this book's about. I'm sure I'm one of the very few people in this room, if not the only one, who had the opportunity to sit and talk to Bill Wilson for an hour, the founder of AA. And that's what he felt as of 1963 when I talked to him. I don't think he changed his mind afterwards. But say, how can that be? Of course the problem is alcohol. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Hospitals turn out recovered people. Genesis turns out recovered people. Jails turn out recovered people. They don't. They turn out people with varying amounts of information and data about their problem. But if they be like me, I will guarantee you that sooner or later, unless something dramatic happens, they must always eventually begin to drink again. Well, if the problem isn't alcohol, what the hell is it? Is it something mysterious, something spooky, something you have to pay extra to learn about? No. Something you hear about every day. But if you are like me, your preconception of it may be stronger than what you're trying to hear and may kill you. The problem we are confronting here is something that sounds like alcohol but isn't. It is something called alcoholism. You say, alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. Big difference. Someday, if you are like me, your life will depend on remembering the difference. There's a lot of differences. You can talk about them for hours. But in one sentence, let me put it this way. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. In this strange, denigrating, destructive, emotionally eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking has no significant effect on your life in the long run, other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. The thing that makes alcoholism a fatal disease is that the apparent recovery is the more painful aspect of the illness. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That just predisposes you to be an alcoholic. There are millions of people who have all the emotions you and I do, we think we're so unique. But they are called acute or intense neurotics. They are people who fill the psychiatric cultures of the world saying the same things we say to our sponsor. Why am I different? They are the people for whom things like Valium and Thorazine and Seconal and Darvon and all the slow-down drugs have been created to slow down intense neurotic personalities. but they are not alcoholic. Nearly all of them never will be, and nor can they be, because something else must be present. We hear about it all the time, AA, but we don't, if you're like me, would have no idea what it means.
They talk about, Walter, there must be an allergy of the body.
What the hell does that mean?
Never mind. Just accept.
That isn't good enough. That isn't good enough for me. I mean, it wasn't. I had to find something I could understand. It turns out that to be an alcoholic, in every generation, 5 or 6% of people, and nobody knows why, and it's been going on as far back as they can trace, there's memories of it in Egypt and Babylonia. 5 or 6% of people get an unnatural reaction to alcohol, and they don't know why, and nobody knows why, and they don't know it's an unusual reaction, and the people around them don't know they're getting it. And Bill Wilson, when he tried to describe it, called it an allergy of the body. Dr. Silkworth called it a sensitivity that I can't quite... So what is this unnatural reaction? What is this allergy? Once you understand, it should be easy. Well, maybe if you're an alcoholic, you stay drunk all the time. That sounds realistic. False. It is impossible for a human body to stay drunk 14 days and nights in the laboratory. You can't stay drunk. That's one of the rottenest parts about being a drinker. You keep sobering up. Maybe you can't handle alcohol. That must be it. False. Tests have indicated alcoholics handle alcohol better than social drinkers in almost any situation. If you've ever been to a party where alcoholics and non-alcoholics drink the same, I'll guarantee you the alcoholics drive the non-alcoholics home. But you can't ever get the non-alcoholics to drink that much. It's hard to run the test, you know. No more for me. I'm starting to feel it. And the answer to that is, feel this, you wussy. Is it that alcoholics get crazy? Because you hear all these speakers. They've all done such bizarre things.
And then I broke out of Sing Sing, raped 24 nurses, and went to Menninger's clinic and got sick. You know, boy.
Some people do that, but that's not how you mark an alcoholic. I'm in a different situation than most of you, as you know. When I go to work in the morning, I have to step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my office. And when I go home at night, I step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my car. I'm surrounded by death all the time. And most of these people have never been bizarre once. In fact, they become catatonic, just the opposite. Some people become bizarre, some never do. Then what is it? What is this unnatural effect? And once you begin to understand that, it all starts to make sense. It turns out that the unnatural effect is not what alcohol does to you at all, because it does something different to different people. It has to do something special for you. That's what makes an alcoholic. What does it have to do for you? It must almost instantly take people who don't feel like quite enough and make them feel more than enough. It must almost instantly take people who feel vulnerable and weak and make them invulnerable. It almost instantly must take people who feel afraid and make them feel momentarily omnipotent. It must fill holes. It must make me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening. And I had no idea. I thought that did that for everybody. I always thought it did that for everybody. And if they didn't drink, it meant they didn't need to have that feeling. But if it does that for you, I'm telling you, you have a better feeling than... It's the best feeling I know. I've been working... They talk about narcotics. I've been working with narcotics addicts for over a quarter of a century. I know a little bit about narcotics addicts. I can tell you about heroin. Gets you great euphoria, but you can never... After a while, a very short time, you can't get back there. You have to overdose. Overdosing is what always kills heroin addicts. They're trying to get back to that euphoria. They can't quite get back there. They must always be watched. Cocaine gets you way up there. Now crack. Can you imagine crack has become so available? Guys on Skid Row are addicted to crack. But you get your way up there in momentary omnipotence, everything's wonderful, but pretty soon the side effects of speed drugs get to you, the paranoia, the terrible restlessness, the terrible addiction, and that your body starts to go and you're trapped. But alcohol, if it's working right for you, puts you right where you are with all your holes filled. You want to try me, copper?
Take your job and shove it, Mr. Carlson. You with anybody, Granny? Nothing changes, but it looks the same. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's great. There's only one trouble. There's something else that comes with this physical thing. It seems to set up a craving for more. No one has ever been able to describe why. I have a theory on it that's as good as anybody's, I guess. At least I believe it to be true for people like me. And that is this. When you feel so bad, you need a drink. So, tell you, when you need a drink bad and you take a drink, there's almost an orgasmic feeling. That first drink just, oh, God. Just, oh. Remember sitting on a bar stool, almost falling off. Just, oh, it feels so good. It just, but it does something. It gives me that edge. But the trouble with it is, it has a quick fade on it. It starts to fade almost immediately. So you have another drink to hold it. And you have another drink to hold it. And you have another drink to hold it. Pretty soon you're drunk. Don't want to be drunk. If I'm sure there are people in here who have done what I used to do when I was young. Go in the can. Put your finger down your throat. Throw up. So I can come back and have that edge and that fun. But sooner or later, you're always going to drink to excess. Sooner or later. And so then you got to start getting in trouble with drinking. Then you're going to stop drinking. You're going to stay sober for a while. Then you remember why you're drinking. Because sobriety is where pain is. Fear. Loneliness. Feelings of difference. Not being enough. And drinking is getting me in trouble. There's a little thing in chapter 3 that people always laugh when they read about because it sounds funny. It talks about what people do. Change from beer to scotch to brandy, drinking beer only, never drinking at home, always drinking at home, on and on. We all laugh, ha ha ha. But we've all done those things for this, because of a very simple reason. Why do people do that? Because they're trapped in a terrible obsession. I've got to believe that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. Because I can't live without it. And it's getting me in deep trouble when I drink. I got to find a compromise. Maybe if I only drink at home. Maybe if I only drink beer. Maybe if I only on and on. If I take physical exercise. Maybe if I read spiritual literature. Maybe if I get psychoanalyzed. Maybe. But nothing ever happens. It always gets back. You wind up in a situation finally. And it turns out it has nothing to do with age. It's when it begins to happen. Some people get this reaction to alcohol from the very first drink. That unusual thing. Some people drink for 30 years before they get it. But then they get in the same situation. That's why we have the paradox in AA. Old guys get up like, say things like, I drank for 30 years. And look accusingly at some little snot as if to say, how could you be an alcoholic? You haven't even 30 years old. They don't realize that little snot is sitting there looking at them thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 30 years, you old son of a bitch. You know? It turns out it isn't when it begins to do it for you. And you wind up in a condition where you can't stay drunk and you can't stay sober. And it's got nothing to do with being on Skid Row, because I've had the opportunity to sponsor people who are still making $500,000 a year on their bottom. And the guy who put the flag on the moon and the psychiatrist and the priest, and they weren't all on Skid Row. What do we all have in common? We all wound up where sobriety was untenable and drinking was untenable. That condition is called alcoholism. And nearly everybody who has it today, with all the help available, is estimated over 90% of alcoholics in America still die drunk. And why do they die drunk? Because they die drunk for the very same feeling you and I have had, and that if we don't tend it, we will have it again. But I am not really an alcoholic. You don't understand. My problems came when I was sober. I just drank for relief. And what they don't realize, they've just defined the disease of alcoholism. And the reason that's important to remember, so that you will not be like the millions of people who have come to AA and stayed sober a while and left convinced that AA doesn't work. They come and stay sober for a while and go to meetings, and pretty soon the feelings come back. Restlessness, discontent, feelings of difference, boredom, all these things. They say, man, it doesn't work for me. I don't suppose there's a long-term drinker on Skid Row who's dying on the street who hasn't been AA. Everybody's been AA, long-term drinkers. And there's people going all of that. Then what the hell is it? That's why we have to get together, people like us, and share our experience, strength, and hope, so we remember to do something.
Remember to understand that getting sober is not the point of AA. Getting sober is the front porch of AA. When you get on that front porch, you dry off. But pretty soon, pain's going to come, because that's the natural state of sober alcoholics. Then you have your choice. If you think, oh, my case is different, and running away into endless depravity almost, or else you can step into the house. And in the house is where AA is. And what's in there is things like developing some interpersonal relationships and taking actions and making commitments and obeying, following the commitments, and hopefully getting a sponsor that you could not intimidate. Someone who may be gentle, someone who may be rough, whatever you need, but someone to whom you will subordinate your judgment in moments of stress, who you will give the power to tell you what to do. And over a period of time, you'll take 12 steps. One of the bad things about some treatment facilities, I'm sure it's not Genesis, but some treatment facilities, they release people from the hospital thinking they've taken the 12 steps. They're convinced they've taken the 12 steps. You say, we're going to work, now you're out of the hospital, and hey, we're going to work on the steps. Don't need to work on them. Not going to work on them. I took them in treatment. And it's kind of funny, except they commit suicide that way. Because you can't take these 12 steps in 28 days, or 28 weeks, or 28 months, or 28 years. There's always something you got to be dealing with. It's like driving down the road from Atlanta today. Long straight road. The driver didn't hold the wheel like this, no matter how straight the road. It's always like this. It's always like this, because there's bumps in the road, no matter how smooth your life is. We claim that we all want serenity. But I don't suppose any alcoholic could stand 2 days of pure serenity. You didn't. You just couldn't stand it. You might think, you could say, oh, I'm wonderfully serene. I've never been so happy. But after about a day and a half, this hand starts dips in the septic tank. And look what attacked me now. The reason that's important, and you got to keep working on things. Because, you know, you can go to hear speakers, and it sounds so nice. They say, in a short talk, they got to say, well, I was all right. Then I got sick. Then I got well. Now I'm wonderful. Yeah. But that isn't the way it is in real life. It takes years. You go, oh, I'm downhill. Oh, I think I got under control now. I just drink beer on Friday. Well, Jesus, you know. Takes a long time to get down there. And when you get back, you say, I found a new way of life, a program of 12 simple steps, and oh my God, I can't stand it. It's a long pull, because you got to deal with emotions that are human emotions. The best advice I can give you is throw yourself into AA. Do not allow yourself to fall into programs where they convince you that you are a victim, because it will momentarily make you feel better, but you will never get better. You will live as a bitter victim as long as you live. AA also knows some of us have been victimized, but they say, let's look at it, let's discuss it, and then to hell with it. That was then, and this is now. Let's not take the rest of my life living back there, for Christ's sake. You know, Dr. Bob, co-founder of AA, his son lives in Texas. His name is Bob Smith. He's about 75 now. I was kidding him a few years ago. I said, I suppose you're going to become the president of adult children, you know, because you're the oldest living adult child of an alcoholic. And he got pretty testy with me. He says, I decline to be frozen into the role of an 18-year-old neurotic. Now, I know that there are some forms of ACA that help people get better. But when you have to pay for it, they're going to keep you sick, in my opinion. That's only my opinion. And Bill Wilson's and Dr. Bob's and God's. I want is how much time we got left? Huh? I want to just add one more thing. I want to say a thing. I haven't talked about this for a long time. I mean, I know a lot of people have got a long way to go to get home, and I'll be home by Thursday. But when I was new in AA, there weren't hardly any treatment centers. You know, treatment centers were not even heard of. There were a few sanitaria, and they were just terrible, turning out drunks, and the Keeley cure that made people worse, and revulsion treatments. And as the years went along, treatment centers came in, and they started to flourish, and there were big chains of them. And a lot of the old-timers said, goddamn treatment centers! Ah!
on, be a man, buddy! You know, on and on. Terrible fights. And I was one of them. And over the years, I become acclimated to the fact that there are purposes for some treatment centers and not for others. There are good treatment centers and bad. And that I certainly believe that Genesis is a good one. If you didn't, I wouldn't be here. I may be wrong, but if I didn't, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't go and talk for a bad treatment center. But say, what's the difference between a good treatment center and a bad treatment center? One time I was talking at an international convention in Montreal, and I was trying to think of an analogy. And maybe the best I ever thought of in the spur of the moment. Why would people go to a treatment center when they just go to AA? Why spend $1,000 at a treatment center when you go to AA for nothing right now? I thought to myself, it's like going down to the beach in Santa Monica. Somewhere beyond the horizon is Catalina Island. And you can go down there. I want to go to Catalina, and here's a neat, trim, little ship called the SS Treatment Center. People in clean white jackets. Nice smells coming out of the galley saying, come with us. We will help you to get to Catalina. And down the beach, there's a couple kind of guys scrounging around the tall grass saying, we're from AA. You want to go with us? We got an invisible boat. Well, not much choice there. Really wonderful. I think my Blue Cross will cover this. And good luck to you, pal. So they get the treatment center, and the treatment center does exactly what it says it should. Dries them off, makes them feel good, feeds them, straightens them out. The only problem is it just gets out of sight of land and says, well, we have to turn back now. So, Catalina's that way. Swim like a sumbitch. And you're out there swimming, and here comes these two boobs in their invisible boat. Do you want to ride? I'm not that sick. Pretty soon you're almost drowning, you're not any closer. You want to ride? Yeah, let me get in your boat. Get in the boat and rinse off and send your wrist. I'm floating in midair. There's no boat here. These people are crazy. What do you want me to do? Oh, grab an oar and row. Screw you. Pretty soon you're just about dead, and they pick you up again and say, you want to ride? Yeah. What do you want me to do? Row. Grab an oar and row. Oh, you crazy bastards. And the odd thing is, as you begin to row, the boat begins to appear. But it doesn't appear until you begin to row. So you've got to be kind of desperate to row. And you're rowing pretty soon, the boat gets bigger than the yacht. You don't even want to go to Catalina. Stay on this baby. That's what sponsors are for. They come around every so often and say, hey, you got your oar upside down. Oh, I could... Now, the difference between good treatment centers and bad is this. Bad treatment centers take you out of sight of land and say you're in good shape. You now know enough to make it. Do it. And they leave you to die. Good treatment centers say, this is as far as we can go. We have to turn back. But just swim for a while. And when those two goofs come along in their invisible boat, jump in. And that's really what it's about, because that's all we do. Most of AA is just getting together to remind one another to keep rowing. Because the irony about it is, if you stop rowing long enough, it disappears. And you're back in the water. It's an odd, odd thing. That's as straightforward as I know how to explain it. You row when there's nothing to row, and the boat appears. You stop rowing, and it disappears. And Alcoholics Anonymous continues to work for people like us. In the last 3-4 years, I've had the chance to talk in exotic AA meetings like in Christchurch and Auckland, New Zealand, and Tahiti, and Hawaii, and Mexico, and Canada, and London, and Belfast, and Dublin, and Glasgow, and Paris, and Berlin. You think, boy, wouldn't it be exotic to be in those places? Except for the accents, you might as well just stay home, you know. Sit in a meeting in Berlin, think, well, here's something on, here's some boob behind you. But I don't think you really understand. I'm afraid my teeth is different.
Hello there.
Let's have coffee over the meeting. I'll tell you about my case. What's amazing about Alcoholics
how similar they are at such a low level, at a deep level. That's why this simple stuff appears simple, works for everybody. That's why what's so sad is that people, before they work it, or they do not work it, they say, I can tell by looking at it and hearing about it, it isn't enough. I need something else. In all the history of mankind, nothing has ever helped. There are more people sober in this room than there were in the United States in 1935 with all the treatment therapies available. And the biggest problem you and I have to do is come to believe that this is something which is given to us for nothing and is readily available and isn't very mysterious, literally can change your perception of reality. Because that's what AA is about. It isn't to make you holy. It is not to make you wonderful. It's to very slowly do, I think, what alcohol does fast. It's to take people who don't feel quite enough and make them feel most of the time enough. It takes people who feel afraid most of the time and makes them not have to feel afraid all the time. Unafraid most of the time. It has to take people who feel extremely vulnerable, make them feel most of the time invulnerable. That's what it does. It doesn't make you wonderful. No matter how hard you work the program, you don't rise above human being. Human beings have emotions and conflicts and problems. But the difference is they are problems, not when they're untreated, they become obsessions. We have to treat problems here. The last thing I want to say is that, before I sit down, is that when I was put in the Texas nut house as a suicide, and I stayed sober, my wife through a pregnancy because I felt so bad because one of our children had died and I was in jail. I swore I was going to stay sober, and I couldn't stand it. Eventually, she was in church with the kids, and I put the car in the garage and hooked up a hose and committed suicide. And the guy pulled me out dead, and they rushed me to the hospital and examined me and determined I was a badly split personality, schizophrenic, paranoid schizophrenic, and committed me for an indefinite period to the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. Well, I thought that would interrupt my career. So I escaped. They brought me back, gave me a lot of electric shock treatments. After that, you don't ever run much after that. You just... You remember my name?
I don't.
Am I Hart Schaffner and Marx? And I realized, how am I going to get out of here? And I suddenly realized, they had an alcoholic ward. I'd been in and out of AA for 7 or 8 years by that time. So I pretended to be an alcoholic. I knew how... I want to find a way of stopping drinking, of finding a new life under God. And I finally got transferred to the alcoholic ward. I remember the first day I was there. I've been living in Texas for some time. I hadn't been to AA there because I was in the real world now. And I know how they do it. They don't do it here in Georgia, but they do it in Texas. They do it in some parts of Louisiana. They do it in some parts of Alabama. It's just a terrible thing. When you're coming off shock treatments, anyway, it's a terrible thing, you know. I remember sitting in there, and I'd been to AA meetings. Now, tonight they said, guy gets up here and says, my name is Fred, I'm an alcoholic. Nobody says, hi, Fred. But in Texas, they say things like, my name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing drugs since my sobriety date. And for this, I'm truly grateful. And then they say, oh, Fred. I guess that's all right, but when you're coming off shock treatment, you know. I remember thinking to myself, if I ever got in a chance where I was in a position of power and authority, I wouldn't give them some hideous chant like that. I'd tell them the truth. And since then, I have been in that position several times, and I am tonight. So I'm going to tell you what it's really like. I tell you what I have found in AA, not what some old fool in Texas chants. I'll tell you what reality finds for you. I discovered, I told you earlier, I was an alcoholic after I was sober a while. That was nice. So I can say my name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. And here's what else I learned. I discovered in AA that through the grace of God and the power of the simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing drugs since October the 31st, 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful. Keep rowing. Thank you.